Hello and welcome to The Stack, a very exciting edition of the show today. Politico is expanding in France. We speak to the people behind the move and also the success of the Week Junior, aimed at 8 to 14-year-olds. And finally, a wonderful new title for fans of American football. It's called Spiral. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, I speak with Karen O'Connor, chief executive for The Week and The Week Junior, and also Sean Gassemitari from new title Spiral. But first on the show, let's talk Politico. The media company specialized in political journalism have more recently started to invest and expand its presence in France. We know their incredible reports and newsletters coming from the United States, United Kingdom, and of course Brussels. But now Paris will be in the limelight too. More recently, they've launched the Politico Playbook Paris newsletter, with all the ins and outs of French politics, a must-read for all interested in Gaelic politics. I had the pleasure to speak with Pauline de Saint-Rémy, author of Politico's Playbook Paris, and Marion Soletti, incoming executive editor for Politico France.
I think for us, it was just the natural next step in our development. Obviously, we're now very big in Brussels. We have a full newsroom, and we also have a good team in London, where Brexit has been a real booster for us, because it's obviously a new saga that has been playing to our strengths. And for us, the next stage was really to expand on the continent. And Paris seems the natural place to go for several reasons, including, you know, news momentums. We have a presidential election coming next year. So that's obviously a good time to launch for a news outlet like us, who specialize in politics.
And Pauline, I've been reading, since Politico Playbook Paris started. I mean, it's really interesting. And as Marion was saying, what an exciting time to start, especially with the presidential election next year. But it also means that I'm sure you're quite busy, because it's quite a lengthy newsletter. I think I always learned so much reading each one of them.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of things happening already. I mean, in Paris, we usually say that 18 months before a presidential election, we're already starting to talk about it. I mean, between journalists and politicians. So there are a lot of things to say already.
For example, if I may say, what's on the agenda this week, for example? What are kind of the main stories politically wise in France?
We were talking about climate quite a lot at the moment, because Emmanuel Macron wants to organize a referendum to ask French people if they want to put climate change, or I mean the fight for climate change, against climate change in their constitution. So that's something we've been talking about too this morning, and we'll be talking about it this week. And I mean, moreover, there's another election coming up before the presidential election. It's supposed to happen in June. The regional election. So that's something people are talking about a lot too.
Well, that's a busy week. Any week is a busy week these days. And Marion, I'm going to ask you as well about those newsletters, kind of this format for Politico as a brand. I mean, I have to say, as a Politico kind of reader, I just love them. Do you think, I feel the newsletters in general, in the whole of media, they are getting more and more importance. What do you think about that?
I think there is a very simple reason for that, is the kind of overload of information that everyone is facing, right? And newsletters are just a very efficient format to get the news you need in your inbox in just one or two pager. And newsletters at Politico specifically are really designed for that, you know, to be the one-stop shop for your news in the morning. If you read our newsletter, you're supposed to be kind of prepared for your day, not to have missed anything big. You know, there is with flags of relevant content elsewhere. We have it's agenda driven, so you know what to expect. And obviously you have the extra info brought in by the reporters.
And I was going to ask to Pauline, because I know Politico is kind of expanding. For example, I got in my newsletter a few days ago, something about China Direct and Politico, which is quite interesting as well. Pauline, how do you work there at Politico? I mean, do you have, I know you might have your team there in France, but do you guys
talk to each other? You talk to the US team, to the London team. How is that involvement between the political team?
Well, actually, that's something I'm kind of still discovering, because I only arrived in January, so I haven't even met everybody yet. Also, I just went to Brussels once, but we do talk to each other a lot, of course, and I've had a lot of help by the French team. The reporters in Brussels and in Paris, of course, have their own specialties, and of course they help me on specific subjects. Almost every day one of them offers to help on a technical issue, I have a lot of help from other reporters.
And Marion, I would like to ask, it's something that actually I don't have, but I'm curious, when I go to the website of Politico, there's something called Politico Pro. Is that for people that want even more in-depth articles, even, to find out even more about the stories? If you can tell us a bit more about that and, how does involving the business side of Politico?
Of course. That's what we call the iceberg model at Politico, right? We have free coverage, we cover politics, elections, the usual stuff, and we also have a subscription service, which is Politico Pro, which is really designed for professionals of politics. So it's only subscription by companies usually who are working directly around politics. So institutions, NGOs, public affairs professionals. And here we cover currently 12 policy areas, so from trade to healthcare to financial services, energy, mobility, tech, and it's really about all covering the policy making in these areas on a daily basis. So we actually send usually a morning newsletter for each of these areas. So some people receive 12 morning newsletters from Politico in their inbox. They're not complaining until now, and obviously we give them very granular information about what's going on in terms of negotiations between European member states, between the parliament and the council, on specific files, all the kind of really big legislative package or free trade agreements that are processed at the EU level and across the EU.
And one question that perhaps it can be to both of you, but I find it interesting about Politico as well. These days, media is so fragmented and there's a lot of accusations. People say, oh, the New York Times is too much to the left, or I don't know, this publication is too much to the right. I feel that in Politico, you kind of, even though there might be, an agenda behind, but it's quite hidden. I think it's really telling, the story as it is. Or do you have any complaints from readers saying, oh, you're favoring this politician or not? Do you know what I mean? Or are you also involved in this kind of thing that we're seeing in recent years? Across media?
I think, what's very important for Politico as a brand and as a, as a news organization is our kind of non-partisan line. So we really make sure, we give the same weight to every side of the political spectrum. Contrary to a lot of media organizations, we never take a line. We always try to make sure all sides of the debates are represented, and it's quite important for credibility, also for our kind of B2B business, which is Politico Pro, that we look at the news and at political news without bias.
I've never had complaints until now, but I've only started 2 weeks ago. So.
Hopefully we'll stay that way.
Of course we get complaints, all medias do, but it's a rather good sign when you get complaints from all sides, if you see what I mean. So.
And finally, Marion, I just want to ask this, because I've been always fascinated about, the French presidential elections. I think, they're quite exciting, because I think the president in France still has so much power in a way. It's quite a powerful kind of figure, no matter who is the winner. Do you think it's going to be easy for Macron to be reelected? Do you have any early guesses, or is it still too early to say?
It's definitely not going to be easy for Macron. There's one thing you really have to bear in mind. I don't know how much you know about French politics, but is that we usually say that a year and a half, and even a year before a presidential election, things might seem like you can tell in advance who the candidates are going to be, who is going to reach the second second tour. How do you say second tour? Sorry. But that's never the way things happen. If you look back in time in 2017, who would have guessed that Macron was going to happen? There was the story about François Fillon, who seemed like our future president. That didn't happen, as you may know. And even before that, of course, the other elections were full of surprises. There was, of course, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, which led to François Hollande's his election, and so on and so on. So I wouldn't try to guess what's going to happen. I'm sure it's going to be full of surprises. And I'm also sure it's going to be complicated for Emmanuel Macron.
That was Pauline de Saint-Rémy and Marion Soletti from Politico. For more info, go to politico.eu. And now to a magazine sector that is booming, the one aimed at kids. And a perfect example of that is The Week Junior, an insightful weekly title aimed at 8 to 14-year-olds that covers everything from farmers' strike in India to the Super Bowl. The title is celebrating a bump in circulation. For more insights on the market and more about The Week and The Week Junior, I spoke to their chief executive, Karen O'Connor.
We treat children as news peers. So what we try and do is have an eyeball-to-eyeball conversation with the child. So if you think about children, they spend their life being told what to do. You know, they're in parent and teacher relationships, so quite often they're instructed. And what we decided to do was to try and be a kind of news discovery and explorer, to be something that was by the side of the child. So they were always sort of saying, this is amazing, this is interesting, done like that, look at this, this is good. And so we're a constant fountain. And when we were coming up with the idea for the magazine, we were really, really concerned that there wouldn't be enough to write about. So we were like, oh my God, you know, we're going to produce this magazine and there won't be enough to go into it. And every week we have to chuck stuff out. So every week we're always thinking, okay, we'll have to save that for another time, or we'll think about something else. So there's a constant supply of things that you can find interesting for a child. And our role is to make the world interesting to a child.
Well, and the numbers are there as well. The magazine has been doing very well. I believe it's going to celebrate 1 year, at least in the US, in a few weeks' time, right?
Yeah, we launched on March the 23rd, 2020. So just as the world was heading into the pandemic, certainly in the UK was about to enter lockdown and the US was going to be hit. And we're based in New York. And so the US edition is nearly a year old. The editorial team has never produced an issue together in the same office. Everything has been done online.
And clarify a few things for us. You have, the US edition and the UK one. Are they quite similar in tone, or are there any differences?
Yeah, there's a few differences, but there's not as many differences as you'd think. I think when we researched the US market, we looked into what children's aspirations were, and they shared the same aspiration. They both wanted to be YouTubers. So the number one job aspiration was to be a YouTuber. But underneath that, there were quite marked differences. So in the UK, they're more creative, probably a bit more fun kind of industries. And in the US, the children were more serious. They wanted to be professionals. So they were, you know, they wanted to be doctors, lawyers, finance people. In the UK, they wanted to be pop stars, football players, inventors. So there was a kind of, I think in America, the children are probably straighter than the US children. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I just mean that they're just probably a little bit more straightforward in terms of their aspirations and their interests. And the other big key difference with the US market is that parents are really involved. So in the UK, you know, and again, it's a generalization, we found that parents don't seek to be as involved in their children's upbringing as they do in the US. So in the US, the child is far more a reflection of the parent than it is in the UK. So for example, we're finding about 60% of the parents in the US read The Week Junior, and I'd say it's about 15% in the UK. So there's much more involved in the kind of their children's inputs and understanding of how their children are developing.
That's fascinating. And again, you're dealing with a market 8 to 14-year-olds. I think you have quite an important role as well, because that's kind of the market that hopefully we'll be reading magazines in the future as well. So, yeah. I mean, I guess when you're 14, you can almost like move to The Week Junior to The Week, right? Which are also involved.
Yeah. I mean, the original insight for this publication came about from The Week, which is that we had lots and lots of families where The Week was the very first way that children onboarded into reading news. So, you know, you would meet kind of 15, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds who read The Week because their mum and dad read The Week. And so with The Week Junior, it was really to say, OK, well, if we've got all these teenagers reading it, how do we speak to the younger market? And so we took that insight and that allowed us to go away and develop a news magazine for children. And the project originally began as a digital project because every single person I spoke to said, it's digital only. Just, you know, there's just no point. Don't bother with the magazine. These children don't care about print. And it was just not true. I mean, the more we looked at it, it was just nonsense. So, you know, the fastest growing market for reading was children's books. So there's been a complete renaissance in the way that children approach print. And it's not been matched by magazines. And so magazine publishers tend to look at quite specific audiences like 25 to 35. But it was a part of the market where it was very, very poorly serviced. You know, you had, you know, pre-reading magazines, you had magazines with toys, but you didn't have very much that was aimed at the 8 to 14 year olds.
Yeah, you're very right. I mean, I had this image of, you know, magazine for kids, you know, with a big toy and actually not much editorial content, which is completely different than yours. I know you had a lot of positive numbers. How is the magazine sold these days? Is it mainly through subscriptions, or is there a difference again in the market? Because in the UK, I always had the image that there was still quite a lot of newsstand sales, and in the US was more subscription.
The US is completely subscription, and in the UK, it's very small numbers. It's a couple of thousand copies. So it's really a very small business for us. It's a direct-to-consumer business. And the way that we run the business is through digital marketing. So, you know, if you're thinking about the responsibilities of a magazine like The Week Junior, it's a pretty big responsibility to be a brand that comes and explains the world to children. So you have gatekeepers in the form of the parents who you have to convince first, right? So, you know, our branding and marketing relationship begins with the parents. And so when we advertise and when we market, we often feature parents inside it. We often feature children talking about their reaction to the product. We get a lot of word of mouth. So we get a lot of kind of people doing it because it's right. So we put a lot of emphasis into our digital marketing about supporting parents. We do guides, we do activity hubs. We do a lot of work on Instagram, and Pinterest is our big market now that we're beginning to develop loads of boards. So activity boards for parents, ways to help. So our marketing engine is aimed at the parents as opposed to the children.
And Karen, I mean, I would also like to ask you about The Week. I mean, how has been The Week since last March when the pandemic started? How did it affect it? I know The Week Junior been doing, you know, very well, very interesting. But I'm just curious because the whole pandemic changed so many sectors. And I wonder how did it affected The Week as well?
Yeah, I think on The Week, it was very beneficial for subscription sales. So we saw a lot of more organic subscriptions, and we saw a lot more PPC activity, and we saw more social activity. But I think for The Week, the world is beginning to turn back to the values of The Week. So I think if you think about the last 3 or 4 years, they've all been about polarization, and they've all been about people assuming that they're correct, and they've all been about assuming that they're in one particular area. So your tribal loyalty becomes more important than factual knowledge. And for The Week, you have to be open-minded to read it. So the entire point of The Week is that you're going to be presented with multitude opinions, right? And so as the world begins to become more open, I think there's going to be a lot of positivity in the culture. So I think the big shift we're going to see in a post-Trump world is more open, more positive. And I think The Week Junior ties into that. So I'm by nature, I'm an optimist. But I really do feel that the culture is going to begin to turn, because I think people are weary and they're a bit tired. So I think brands that are about helping or enabling or seeing both sides or being more pragmatic, those kind of brands are going to flourish, I think, in the next couple of years. And I think the angrier brands are going to, they probably reach their peak in terms of their audience size. It's quite hard to see how they grow any bigger without just basically eating themselves, you know? So they just splinter and they become smaller and smaller. So I think this is going to be an interesting time for news providers in the next couple of years.
That was Karen O'Connor, and you can buy the weekly editions of both The Week and The Week Junior in the best newsstands and on their website as well. Finally on the show, a new sports magazine that is visually beautiful, and it aims to cover the cultural aspects of American football. Even for those who don't know much about the sport, Spyro is a delight. Published annually, each issue explores a theme and uses football as a jumping-off point to talk about all matters of culture that surround the sport, from art and design, music and fashion, to politics and sport. I spoke to its founder and editor-in-chief, Sean Gassemitari.
As someone who grew up loving football, kind of inheriting that from my father, I always felt that, you know, football was also, it could also be expressed in such a cultural way and showing the artistry and how it's affected so many different aspects of culture, from music to art and design to fashion. And with the pandemic having hit, I just felt that maybe this was the best time for me to really pursue this passion project of mine. And it's been so, it's such a blessing to see how many people kind of believed in this vision before it really ever came to life. And I think that's kind of how it became this almost book of a magazine and just jam-packed with content.
Well, and tell us about your connection with American football. I mean, did you used to play as a kid? I mean, what's the connection?
Yeah, so my parents immigrated from Tehran right around the Iranian Revolution in 1978, 79. And they immigrated to San Francisco. And so San Francisco during the 80s, the 49ers, the professional football team, they were kind of the team of the decade. And so sports is kind of one of the first ways many foreigners in any country kind of assimilate into a certain society. And my father really kind of fell in love with the game, and I would basically grow up with his passion for the sport. And so growing up, I would love to play football. I played a few years of high school football at Granada Hills in Los Angeles. And then meanwhile, I've always had an interest in art and design and music and fashion. And you know, I went to school for journalism, so I kind of have a writing background, and I've worked in different areas of, you know, street fashion brands and different design agency settings. Through it all, I always felt that I was more of a writer at heart, and sports was always an avenue that I was very interested in, but I felt that there was never much representation for. But, you know, we have such great European football magazines around the world, like Soccer Bible, Gaffer, Mundial. And you also have like your franchise magazine in America, which is a great basketball magazine. But I always felt that football, despite how popular it is, despite how many aspects of culture it touches on, it never truly had something like that. And I just really made it my mission to bring it to life.
I agree. I didn't come across any kind of American football titles that are like yours, you know, looking at the cultural side of things as well. And I have to say, Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I know it's a quintessentially American sport, but it's kind of trying to expand internationally as well. So I think there'll be quite a lot of people from outside the US that might be interested in Spyro as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the response in the UK, our printer is actually in the UK, and they've been telling us the response, despite the pandemic really slowing things down, it's been really great. And I mean, there's been a lot of developments in the UK in terms of Tottenham's new stadium that's actually kind of built for NFL games as well. Mexico City is another very big footballing city that there's been many talks that there could be an expansion team out there. And there also used to be the NFL Europe a decade or so ago, where it really was more of a developmental league, but I think there are still communities of fans all across mainland Europe and certainly all across Canada, which is a big football country. So it definitely is a sport that is confined within the United States, but I could see as the sport evolves with the rule changes and kind of the aggression of the sport getting a little more tamed down, I could see it kind of branching off internationally.
And one thing I would like to mention is I love the design of Spyro. And in fact, I mean, I don't know what was your intention, but I mean, it's called Spyro and the magazine is kind of, there's a Spyro bounce as well.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit, it looks very cool.
So the original name, so I've kind of been working towards this idea for roughly 2 to 3 years now. And the original name was Pigskin, which is just another reference to the old pigskins that they use for the footballs. But my friends, Nick and Tanner, they run a design studio called Fourth and Back. So they were the graphic designers / art directors on this mag. And we were kind of play around with the names, and we kind of thought of the name Spiral. So for anyone unfamiliar, Spiral is the kind of motion of throwing the football forward. And we thought it was such a cool name that doesn't have the on your head reference to football, you kind of have to think a little bit more about it. And we just thought it was so cool that it also references not just the binding of the book, but it also references the old coach's playbook. So way back in the day, we wanted it kind of like a handbook type of feel, where it feels like there's a utility to it. It feels like it feels very good to read as well. Some book formats can be very large and can strain your eye when you try to read it. But we want to kind of strike that balance. And I thought it was a really fun, quirky way to go about it, but it turned out pretty beautiful, I think.
And I know you had some experience, you know, with fashion. One of my favorite kind of stories, you know, I love the illustrations of the uniforms throughout the years. I mean, that was really, really, really nicely done as well.
Thank you.
And if people are interested in Spiro, I mean, what is the best way to buy it? I mean, do you have a website or do you have some stockists at the moment?
Yeah, we have. So we have our website, and I ship out here from LA, but we're also all across the UK from Mac Culture, I believe Village in Leeds, many different shops in London. We're really branching out right now, and we've just gotten to Barnes and Noble across the US. Different kind of independent shops, as you're like your Iconic in New York, Hennessy and Ingalls and Arcana out here in LA. And then on our homepage, there is a stockist tab where you can see everywhere around the world. And it's been pretty pretty amazing.
And Sean, just to give me a lesson here, I mean, what do you have a football team of choice?
My football team, as I said before, was the 49ers from San Francisco. It hasn't been the great. I kind of grew up with my dad's mythology of the team. They had been so successful in the past, and then for most of my life they were pretty a dumpster fire. But they're starting to bring it back around. But I like to consider myself more of a football fan first, and then my Niners second.
No, I ask because, you know, I think the whole idea is that every issue you will have a theme. And the first one is tribalism, right? Why did you choose that as the first?
Initially, the theme name was going to be identity, but identity was pretty broad. So I kind of I thought about, you know, all sports. What is so central to all sports? And I think tribalism is a certain part of it. And tribalism really is, it's not a positive or negative thing, in my opinion. I think tribalism is just something that's inherent to the way our societies have worked. It was trying to highlight this form of identity that can once go out of hand, but that could also give you a sense of community and belonging. And so it was just, it was about like reaching out to different writers and artists who can kind of exemplify this sort of theme, especially for a time like now where, you know, we see tribalism happening all across society, not just sports.
That was Shonga Semitari from Spiro magazine. The first issue is out now. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. And if you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monaco.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, meanwhile, you can always subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, or at the monaco.com website. And before we go, a little song for you from the 30th Super Bowl halftime show. The fabulous Diana Ross about to leave the stadium in a helicopter while singing Take Me Higher. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.